This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Please listen to verse 255 of chapter Baqarah, recited by Mr. Ali Asghar Burumand.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Allahu la ilaha illa
Thank you.
صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Allah is He, besides whom there is no God, the ever-living, the self-subsisting, by whom all subsist. Slumber does not overtake Him, nor sleep. Whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth is His. Who is He that can intercede with Him but by His permission? He knows what is before them and what is behind them, and they cannot comprehend anything out of His knowledge except what He pleases. His knowledge extends over the heavens and the earth, and the preservation of them both tires Him not, and He is the Most High, the Great.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Brazil becomes the world's second country to pass 400,000 COVID-19 deaths amid warnings that the daily toll could remain high for several months due to slow vaccinations. Clashes break out between security forces and protesters in the Colombian city of Cali as anger mounts in the South American country over a government plan tax reform. Also ahead, the death toll from a stampede at a Jewish pilgrimage site in northern Israel rises to 44. Thank you very much for joining us. Our top story, Brazil registers more than 3,000 new COVID-19 fatalities as the country's overall death toll surpasses the grim milestone of 400,000. The US is the only country where the coronavirus has claimed more lives. The Brazilian Health Ministry also recorded nearly 70,000 additional infections, raising total cases to more than 14.5 million. Health experts have warned the daily toll could remain high for several months as the Latin American country struggles to secure enough vaccines while loosening restrictions. Elsewhere in the Americas region, Mexico has reported 529 new deaths from the virus, along with some 4,000 more confirmed cases. Germany, meanwhile, has reported more than 24,300 new cases from coronavirus in the past 24 hours. The figure declined by 400 compared with the daily case tally reported on Thursday. Germany's total cases are now over 3.38 million, with nearly 83,000 deaths. On Thursday, the health minister said the number of infections seems to be heading lower, but he added the decline is not yet deep enough to suggest that the third wave of the pandemic has been broken. Germany's efforts to contain the third wave is complicated by the more contagious UK variant and a relative slow start to its vaccination campaign. Officials say a few cases of the Indian variant have been detected as well.
India has logged yet another record daily rise in its coronavirus cases as it faces severe shortages of medical supplies. The health ministry on Friday registered over 386,400 new cases in 24 hours. That takes India's total tally to more than 18 million, the second largest in the world. The country has been posting record after record in its daily COVID cases in the past few weeks. So that has been blamed on large gatherings as well as people's reluctance to wear masks. The explosion in infections has caused a severe shortage in hospital beds and supplies of oxygen. A number of countries have pledged aid and assistance to India. The US aid has just arrived there. Colombian protesters and riot police have clashed on the second day of demonstrations against a tax reform package proposed by the government. Oosh. Clashes broke out in various locations, including the city of Cali. Reports say one person died there in what was called an incident related to the demonstration. Colombians took to the streets in major cities Thursday for the second straight day. They defied a court order ruling that the marches should be postponed because of the coronavirus situation over there. Let's get back to our story regarding India, which has posted yet another record daily rise in its coronavirus cases, as it is also facing a shortage in medical supplies. The country has recorded over 386,400 new cases in 24 hours. Let's bring in Manawar Zaman, our correspondent from the Indian capital, New Delhi. Manawar, the last time we spoke yesterday, you said that the next few days, or 10 days, I think, were going to be hard and harsh on the Indian health sector and the situation will rise. Sure enough, we've seen another record there in India. How are the hospitals dealing or trying to cope with the situation? Not the government, the hospitals, the medical sector, the staff there, to bring these numbers down?
Well, the hospitals have broken down. They're overwhelmed. There is nothing they can do. They're trying their hard to save as much as life they can. And you wouldn't imagine. They have to make a choice, whom to give the oxygen, whom to give the ventilator. I mean, they have to make the decisions in seconds, depending on whose conditions is what. I mean, the situation is out of words. There is no word that can describe the situation. Till yesterday, we were talking about shortage of oxygen supplies and shortage of beds. Now, that's something which is not to be spoken about now. Now, the biggest trouble the country is facing is the lack of crematoriums, lack of food, lack of burial grounds. I mean, it is the biggest trouble now the country is facing, because people have to queue up to get their loved ones buried, to get their loved ones cremated, because there is no space left. I've spoken with one of the manager of the crematorium. He said yesterday, that's not far away from New Delhi, that's just 15 or 20 kilometers from where I am. He said, in the first wave of the coronavirus, the highest dead bodies we received was 22 in a single day. But day before yesterday, we received 122 dead bodies in a single day, and we had no space left. Now, what the country is doing, what the government is trying to do, they are trying to make makeshift crematoriums to cremate as much as bodies they can. At the same time, graveyards are running out of spaces. People are desperate. People are completely out of their minds. People have lost senses. They have no idea what is going on. And the second thing, that most important thing, is the aid is trickling down. Now, the aid is coming in inside the country from several countries, but it is coming very slowly.
Manawar, thank you. Manawar Zaman there, our correspondent in the Indian capital, New Delhi, joining us. Elsewhere, dozens of Israeli ultra-Orthodox are killed in a stampede at a Jewish ceremony in the town of Meron. Hospital sources say at least 44 people have been killed in the accident, and scores more have sustained injuries. Search and rescue teams say they struggled to evacuate trapped people because the site was so densely populated. The accident occurred at the Lag BOMER event, in which tens of thousands of ultra-Orthodox Jews were attending. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu described the incident as a disaster. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has condemned as a coup the decision by the Palestinian National Authority president to delay parliamentary elections. Hamas said the postponement of the polls doesn't agree with the national consensus and popular support. Mahmoud Abbas said he delayed the elections until voting is guaranteed in Israeli-occupied Jerusalem al-Quds. Hamas had earlier called on Palestinians to explore ways of forcing the elections in Al-Quds without the permission of or coordination with Israel. Abbas's Fatah party and its rival Hamas had agreed to hold legislative polls on May the 22nd. Hamas was expected to do well in the elections, while Fatah's prospects have been threatened by splinter factions. U.S. President Joe Biden has been interrupted by a group of protesters as he began a rally in Georgia. They called on him to close private detention centers.
I want to thank you, the people of Georgia.
And detention now! And detention now!
We'll give you a microphone.
No! And detention now!
Folks!
Biden responded, "I agree with you. Give me another 5 days." In January, the U.S. president signed an executive order that ended federal use of private prisons. Democrats hailed the move as an important step, but there have been calls for more action. Opponents of private detention centers say the facilities are linked with racial injustice. They also say the centers perpetuate mass imprisonment. Foreign forces have started their withdrawal from Afghanistan after some 20 years of presence in the West Asian nation. We discussed the matter with our guests in the News Review program. Let's take a listen to that.
Now the North Atlantic Treaty Organization says it's begun withdrawing its troops from Afghanistan. NATO described the drawdown as an orderly, coordinated, and deliberate process. U.S.-backed military alliance said it plans to complete its pullout in a few months without specifying a date. Separately, the White House confirmed U.S. troops have begun leaving the country as well. President Joe Biden announced earlier this month that the U.S. will withdraw all of its forces from Afghan territory by the 11th of September, ending his country's longest military engagement. NATO has around 9,600 forces in Afghanistan, 2,500 of them American. Joining us now for the program is E. Michael Jones, editor at Culture Wars Online, or Culture Wars Magazine out of South Bend, Indiana, and Scott Bennett, former U.S. Army psychological warfare officer, joining us out of San Francisco, California. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program here. I guess we'll start there with you, Mr. E. Michael Jones. Your initial thoughts after 20 years plus, seems like this thing's about to really happen, isn't it?
Yes, it's been the longest war in the U.S. history. It's also over a crucial piece of territory, which was established by Rudyard Kipling. He called it the Great Game. He said anyone who controls the Hindu Kush controls the Eurasian landmass and the approaches to India. The withdrawal from that is a sign of the shrinking now of the American empire. The American empire just got too big. They can't maintain this anymore, and so the United States is pulling out in a move that is reminiscent of the pullout of Vietnam, where you basically declare victory and then leave the people up to themselves to defend themselves.
Thank you, Mr. E. Michael Jones. And Scott Bennett, welcome to the program, bud. If you're safe and doing well out there in Northern Cali. Scott, your initial thoughts on this. And then when we saw NATO and the U.S. Give that presser last month that they're withdrawing troops and they've achieved their objective there, what was the objective? And was that just was that some kind of a theater? Or was the U.S. and NATO objective really achieved on Afghan soil?
I think they were recognizing that the objective of which was started under George Bush and Dick Cheney, which was based upon a fraudulent false flag attack of the 9/11 situation that was blamed on the former CIA agent Tim Osmond, also known as Osama bin Laden, and then conveniently transferring that guilt over to the nation of Afghanistan and Taliban, and then launching this reckless invasion based on fraud and deceit of the American people of the world, that is finally coming to an end because of the natural deterioration of any effort built on lies. The entire event was built on lies. The entire campaign was built on lies. And it was also accompanied with a music of incompetence and stupidity because they failed to cultivate a soft war, an information war, a psychological war, or campaign, or persuasion operation, whatever you want to call it. They failed constantly, consistently, and inevitably because of the knuckle-dragging stupidity behind the military, State Department, CIA information operations to persuade the Afghan people to enter into some semblance of modernity that is not defined by the U.S., but is defined by a community of nations. So the U.S., by its arrogance and recklessness, has really run out of gas in the entire Afghan theater. It has generated enormous hostility, and now it realizes it's not ever going anywhere. We've run our entire gamut. No one likes us in that country. And the reason that the government and the military are desperate to keep the United States is because of the civil war that is brewing. Now, how that may be contained is another matter, but it has to be done through joint operations, I think, with Russia, with Iran, with China, with neighbors, Pakistan, India. All of the ones that are around that area need to try and cultivate a message operation so that the Taliban are not being self-perceived in violation of the religion, but at the same time, the Afghan government are able to stand up and protect its people from any sort of descent into authoritarianism or warlord rule or anything that resembles that sort of barbaric violence.
And Mr. E. Michael Jones, so after I mentioned 20 years plus, NATO and U.S. Forces, their Afghan project or their Afghan war, whatever you want to call it, let me know your interpretation of what they gained from it and what they lost throughout the time.
It was my understanding that Afghanistan was crucial to the heroin trade. We know that the CIA was involved in the heroin trade in the Golden Triangle in the after the Vietnam War. Because Jimmy Carter had cut off their funding. They needed an extra source of funding, and they started it there. Then when they lost that after the fall of Vietnam, they moved to Afghanistan. This is what everyone that I know is saying this. And the problem was that the Taliban stopped heroin opium production. My understanding was that's why the invasion took place. For every year that the United States was there, the heroin trade, opium trade, increased. So that had to be part of the operation. It seems to me there's no other explanation for what plausible explanation for what was going on there. They then got involved in social engineering. They tried to bring feminism into Afghanistan, and I had the pleasure of getting to meet a young lady from Herat who is here at the University of Notre Dame studying, and she was going to go back and spread feminism among the Afghanistanis. I feel sorry for the people who were involved in this thing. She hasn't gone back yet, but I mean, her predecessor was blown up in a car bomb put there by the Taliban because they saw this as subversive influence. So across the board, it's been a disaster. Disaster for the United States because of the heroin that swept into this country. Disaster for the people of Afghanistan who were lured into collaborating with a group that's now going to pull out and leave them defenseless.
All right, gentlemen, stay safe. Always a pleasure to have you both on. Mr. E. Michael Jones, they're joining us out of South Bend, and Scott Bennett, they're joining us from San Francisco, California. And that's a wrap for the segment of your news review program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
That brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. The Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers, whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness
that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal. And thy word has no failing nor any change. And that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive. And make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans. And muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
The Month of God. In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful, Salam and welcome to the program. We are with you with another episode of the special series for Ramadan. In this blessed month, in addition to abstention from eating and drinking, we can strengthen our inclination for worship through refraining from sins, especially the sins of tongue. Just as gluttony and talkativeness may damage our personality, eating less and taciturnity set the ground for reaching spiritual sublimity. On the 17th night of the blessed month of Ramadan, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, ascended to the heavens. During the ascension or Mi'raj, he asked God, "My Lord, what is the beginning and end of worship?" God answered, "Fasting and silence. O Ahmad, no worship is endeared before me more than silence and fasting. Thus, if a person fasts but is not careful about his tongue, it's like a person who stands for prayer while he does not recite." Of course, this account of the Prophet's life does not mean that human beings should always keep silent. For sure, one should speak for taking his right or defending his right or that of others. Silence means avoiding excessive and unnecessary talk. Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace upon him, says, "Speech and silence are the cause of people's destruction and salvation. So good for the one who is able to recognize good word from evil and is aware of the benefits and pleasant effects of taciturnity and silence. Because silence is the temperament of the divine messengers and the motto of God's chosen servants. If a person knows the value of speech, he will not talk in vain and will stick to silence. The one who is aware of the nuances of silence and makes silence as the trust of his secrets Both his speech and silence will be worship, and nobody is aware of the reality of this worship except God. In this part of the program, we will continue talking about atonement in fasting. Atonement for the nullified fast of Ramadan can be done in one of these three ways. Liberation of a slave, fasting for 2 months, that is 60 days, and feeding 60 poor people. For sure, nowadays there is no slave to liberate, therefore there are only two ways for atonement of the nullified fasting. If a person wants to fast 60 days for atonement, he should fast 31 days consecutively. Then he can fast the remaining 29 days either consecutively or separately. As for women who naturally cannot fast for a few days of the month, they should fast the days after the end of their period. Feeding 60 poor people can be done in two ways. They can either be fed with prepared food, or each of them is given 750 grams of wheat, rice, and the like. Dear friends, as we said in the previous episode, the exact time of the night of Qadr is not clear. But according to the narrations, it is among the 19th, 21st, and 23rd nights. Some ulema also maintain that it can be the 27th night, which is mainly the belief of the Sunni brothers. The 19th night was the night that in the year 48, Imam Ali, peace upon him, was struck the fatal blow on his head by the renegade Abdurrahman ibn Muljam, and the 21st night coincides with the martyrdom of this Imam. Shia Muslims keep vigil all these three nights and spend the nights in prayer, recitation of the Noble Quran, and supplication to God. They also hold mourning ceremonies for the commander of the faithful, Imam Ali, peace upon him. Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, says, "There is a night in this month which is better than 1,000 months. Anyone who is deprived of the blessing of the night of Qadr has been deprived of all bounties. No one becomes deprived except the one who has deprived himself." The three nights of Qadr have two kinds of religious rites. First are the common rites that are performed in all three nights, but the second rare are the ones that are specific for each of these nights. In this episode, let us speak about the common rites. One of the rites on these nights is ghusl, that is the ritual washing of body, which is done near the time of dusk so that one performs his Maghrib prayer after it. Some supplications are commonly read on all three nights. One of them is Joshan Kabir supplication. According to a hadith, God calls on the night of Qadr that he will forgive anyone who performs pilgrimage to Imam Hussein's shrine on this night. Another rite which is done by Shias is to take refuge in the Quran and the 14 infallible persons, that is the Prophet, his daughter Fatima, and the 12 Imams, blessings of God upon them. We open the Noble Quran in front of us and place God on oath by it, and then we keep it on our head and place God on oath by the 14 infallible persons to forgive our sins and plead to Him to fulfill our needs. While keeping the Quran on our head, we repeat the names of the Prophet and his Ahlul Bayt 10 times. On these nights, it is highly recommended to think of and remember much the Redeemer of mankind, Imam Mahdi, May God hasten his reappearance.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Ministry.
And a global war later, Israel is still not able to neutralize its front line with Damascus. With more than 500 illegal Israeli strikes on different parts of Syria, an Iron Dome recognized as the most effective on the planet, and yet Syria's missiles landed in the occupied Naqab Desert near the infamous Dimona. What is even more interesting is that the Israeli occupation regime immediately deemed that this was not an attack, but rather an errant Syrian anti-aircraft missile that had been fired at an Israeli jet during an airstrike on targets in the Syrian Golan Heights. Humor me here. I will give you a timeline of what we know happened, but then I have some simple questions. The Syrian Ministry of Defense announced that its air defenses had responded to an aggression carried out by the Israeli entity against Syrian Arab Army targets near Damascus. Syria's air defenses dropped most of the Israeli missiles. Less than an hour later, at 2 a.m. on Thursday, April 22, incoming rocket sirens were triggered in the northern Naqab Desert in the area near Israel's Dimona nuclear reactor, followed by massive explosions that could be heard throughout much of occupied Palestine. At 3 a.m., Israel's occupation forces spokesperson Jonathan Conricus told Reuters that an errant Syrian missile struck the area around Dimona, but the reactor was not hit by the strike. Now, can someone explain to me how a surface-to-air missile can travel a distance of 250 kilometers from Damascus to Dimona all the way in the occupied Naqab Desert? And why did Israeli jets conduct a second round of airstrikes in Syria after this errant missile landed a few kilometers away from their secret nuclear plant site? And how much of a coincidence was it that a powerful explosion rocked an Israeli missile factory near occupied Al-Quds just hours before the Dimona incident? We'll try answering these questions right here on the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Sirens went off in Dimona town in the Palestinian-occupied Naqab Desert in the early hours of Thursday, April 22, which is home to Israel's infamous nuclear reactor, indicating a possible incoming attack. A missile landed only a few kilometers away from the Dimona plant, which Israel immediately deemed as a missile that has lost its track from the Syrian side. Supposedly, it was a surface-to-air missile that was targeting an Israeli jet raiding Damascus and ended up somehow falling 250 kilometers away from its initial target. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mohammed Abed, political commentator. Thank you for being with us, Mr. Mohammed. Now, Israel immediately declared hours after the missile landed near Dimona that it was an errant Syrian missile, while Syria only officially declared that it fired anti-aircraft missiles against the Israeli jet that was targeting Damascus at that time. Was the Israeli scenario of a missile that lost its track some 250 kilometers away from the initial target a plausible one for you?
Well, no, to say, tell you the truth. It's not even, I think, plausible to many people in the world. Any observer would note that this range of error, if we are to call it this way, would stop us against believing. And the issue that we had a previous case in which an errant surface-to-air missile landed near the Lebanese-Palestinian borders. So to have this range of error, which is about 250 kilometers, I think this weakens the whole story. And the issue of that the Israelis are not even publishing anything about it in today's press, for instance, and just had one unified scenario that is not that much acceptable for a missile that would lose its way. And so from many angles, you don't find this as a plausible narrative.
Well, Mr. Mohammed, many serious questions are clashing right now at the decision-making tables inside of the Israeli entity. The main question is the nature of this so-called incident, as the Israelis are calling it, and the objectives behind it. What do you think was the main objective of hitting so close to Dimona?
Well, you have to take into account all the players that are engaged in this sort of conflict, which is sometimes on a low fire, but sometimes tensions heighten and we see explosions, for instance, like the one we saw on this very day, within 24 hours of the incident of the missile. I mean the Tamir facility, which is a factory of manufacturing missiles near residential areas, by the way. There was an explosion that was taped by many on phones, and the images, the footage toured the world. I mean, you can see it very easily, but still nobody talks about this anymore. You have to take into account this conflict, which is basically taking place between the Islamic Republic of Iran and the Israeli entity. You have a factory that manufactures missiles and do some tests. And the closeness, as I mentioned earlier, to the residential areas, you had this case of an explosion of a test, which remains a lot of questions are raised about it.
Mind you, it happened just hours before the actual missile that landed near Dimona.
Yes, and we come back to the missile. So here you have to take all the players. I mean, the Islamic Republic, Syria. Is Syria trying to change the rules of engagement? As for the Israelis, whenever they like, are launching aggressions on Syria and doing so. Are the Iranians, and they don't want to declare it, taking revenge as for the attacks of Natanz and other Israeli aggressions within Iran or against Iranian targets? So you have to take into account all the players within this very live conflict that we see now.
Mm-hmm. Well, another question hovers around the Israeli intelligence and their defense capabilities, which were utter failure, very much of a failure following the landing of the missile at, quote, the safest place in the world. This is what the Dimona mayor is saying. When on the same day, you just explained to us, just maybe if not the same day, just hours before, on Wednesday afternoon, we saw this huge explosion in the occupied Jerusalem area, which Israel's claim it's an accident that has happened inside of a missile factory inside its territories. How do you think this issue is being maybe discussed behind the closed doors, especially of the Israeli intelligence ones?
Yes, if we weren't within a case of enmity with the Israelis, we'd say, may God help them. Now, they are facing a lot of catastrophes, the attacks that they are launching whenever they want are backfiring. Now, we saw that all the Iron Dome and whatever they call the Arrow missile interception and so, are failing in the face of one missile. So what is the case when hundreds, let's say the least, or thousands maybe of missiles land on the Palestinian occupied territories that are now occupied by the Israelis? So if these systems could not deal with one missile, so what is the case if hundreds of missiles are launched? And I'd like also to comment on this issue of the safest place in the world. I mean, mm-hmm. How can it be as such if you cannot prevent and intercept one missile? What is the case when you have, and this is a main geopolitical change that we've seen within the past 10 years. In the past, Israel used to launch aggressions against all the countries around the Palestine, I mean, and they would have no reaction for that. They could do whatever they want. But now we see that they are not able even to launch an aggression against Gaza, against Lebanon. And now maybe we are witnessing a change of rules of engagement as for this missile. Whoever is the one that the party that launched it, probably will not no longer see Israeli attacks against Syria that go unpunished. So all this within the region is taking place. Also, we have to take into account the negotiations that are taking place, the indirect negotiations between the Islamic Republic and the United States, and the Israelis being unpleasant about it at all, mm-hmm. and they are all expressing their that they do not want to return to the agreement, nuclear agreement.
Hence so why we saw a lot of clashes, maybe some sort of a shadowy Cold War between Israel and Iran in the Mediterranean and the Red Sea. But the failure specifically here inside of the occupied Palestinian territories occupied by the Israeli entity, the failure of the Patriot system to intercept that supposedly surface-to-air missile, we are not sure, and experts are saying that is not even the case here. But the failure of this system, which now just is some sort of an additional loophole to the Israeli intercepting system that is said to be the most effective in the world. We are seeing here Syria and its allies, an entire axis of resistance building upon this incident, having more options on the table, on their own table. Are we at a new phase of countering Israeli attacks against any component of the allied forces of the resistance in West Asia?
Yes, probably we will be seeing this change in the political and in the situation on the ground. As I told you earlier, in the past, I mean, you used to have Israel come and raid Lebanon whenever they wanted. The Palestinian Gaza Strip was not liberated then, but after the liberation also, they launched aggressions whenever they want. So this serves the theory of those who say that the Israelis will not be deterred unless you use force against them. And this is one thing that we probably are witnessing nowadays. Now, if you are imagine yourself one of those who are in the think tanks or in the people who are decision making within the Israeli entity, and you are facing such a situation. In the past, you used to do whatever you want. Now you cannot even launch aggression against the weakest party, as you said, because Syria now, because of the universal aggression that took place against it, this universal war that was supported by at least 80 countries against Syria. So Syria is now the weakest part of the axis of the resistance. So now Syrians probably will be preventing Israel from launching an aggression. This may lead us to another point, which is more strategic. Mm-hmm. The first creation of Israel was to be the West's barracks in the region. And even, by the way, President Biden said this while he was explaining why he supports Israel. Mm-hmm. He said it is cheaper than having any war ship in the Mediterranean, for instance.
Well, it remains so to be seen what will happen next, Mr. Muhammad, especially that the U.S. military itself is being rained upon by missiles inside of Iraq. They can't get a hold of themselves. They want to try and get hold of their own airline here. That's going to be a big issue and a big challenge for them. And I want to thank you very much, Muhammad Abed, political commentator, for being with us to talk about this attack on Dimona, which Israel is deeming just a missile that lost track. Stay with us. Next, we will be talking about the Revolutionary Guards drone footage that is showing the U.S. aircraft carrier in the Persian Gulf.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard has released precise drone footage of a U.S. Navy aircraft carrier in the Persian Gulf, aired on Press TV on Wednesday. The video, which shows the aircraft carrier with warplanes, helicopters, and other military equipment, was reportedly recorded by a four-strong drone squadron, providing real-time and precise details of the U.S. warship. The video comes as the U.S. is still refusing to remove all sanctions off of the Iranian population, as renewed diplomacy are underway to revive the abandoned 2015 nuclear deal. More details about that in this following report.
Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard released drone footage of a U.S. aircraft carrier in the Persian Gulf and clip of a bomber drone test flight on Wednesday, at a time when the Vienna-based talks between world powers to revive the 2015 nuclear deal were underway. The Islamic Revolutionary Guard released strikingly precise and close footage of the American aircraft carrier captured by the elite forces' drones during an overflight of the vessel in the Persian Gulf, vividly portraying its state-of-the-art advancements in the field of drone technology. The footage was undated, but was described by regional media as showing remarkably close details of warplanes and other military aircraft and equipment on the U.S. aircraft carrier. The second part of the footage, entitled Precision Attacks by the Revolutionary Guards, showed kamikaze drones as they are hitting various targets, including a tank. The UAVs are seen slamming into the targets with surgical accuracy and smashing them into fragments. It is not the first time the Islamic Revolutionary Guard displayed its achievements and prowess in drone technology. However, this video was broadcasted on Iranian outlets at a time when the U.S. is still refusing to remove all sanctions off of the Iranian population, as renewed diplomacy are underway to revive the abandoned 2015 nuclear deal. Diplomats from Britain, China, France, Germany, Iran, and Russia have been meeting regularly since earlier this month to discuss reviving the 2015 nuclear deal, while U.S. diplomats are participating indirectly in the talks. Tehran firmly refuses any direct talks with the U.S. before all sanctions are lifted, and the result of the lifting is felt by the government and the people. The Islamic Republic has made it clear that it would by no means settle for the suspension, easing, or extending the waiver of sanctions, repeating what Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei has always echoed. The bans should be removed in their entirety, and Iran will wait to verify of the sanctions removal before returning to its nuclear obligations under the deal.
Now to discuss this issue with us from Tehran is Dr. Hamid Mousavi, political science professor at Tehran University. Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Mousavi. Now, what is the Islamic Republic of Iran trying to say by showing this drone footage of the U.S. Aircraft carrier in the Persian Gulf at a time when before we even mentioned the nuclear deal, at a time when the regional waters are witnessing a shadowy Cold War between Iran and Israel?
Well, I think, first of all, it's a show of strength by Iran. Iran essentially is trying to say that if it is attacked, it has the capacity to respond both to Israeli forces as well as American forces in the region. And from Tehran's perspective, the attack that happened in Natanz, the Americans were also shared a responsibility for it, even though they denied any involvement. We have to remember that even if the Americans were not directly involved, the Israelis, I think they got a green light from the Americans. This happened, the attack on Natanz happened exactly when the U.S. Secretary of Defense was meeting Israeli officials. And the Americans, after the attack, did not denounce the attack, or they did not criticize Israel. They only specified that they weren't directly responsible. So from Tehran's perspective, if Iran comes under attack, then it has the capacity to respond to both the Americans as well as the Israelis.
Well, another aspect of the video that was released by the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps showed kamikaze drones hitting various targets, including one tank, with very much accurate targets, showcasing Iran's state-of-the-art technology in the field of drones. It is worth mentioning that this video was released just 1 week after the Israeli Natanz attack and just 1 day before the Dimona attack inside of the Israeli territory, obviously the occupied Palestinian territories, though the plant was allegedly not hit. We have no evidence of that. Is this phase two of this shadowy war, this shadowy Cold War, if you will, between Israel, or rather just another threat against U.S. presence in the region in general?
Well, I think Iran is trying to show that it has asymmetrical capabilities in responding to both the Israelis as well as the Americans. I don't think we can really distinguish between the Americans and the Israelis, even in this Biden administration, because the Americans have been very much supportive of Israeli policy in the region, and we haven't seen any real changes regarding the Trump administration's policy towards Israel. So in that regard, the fact that the Israelis as well as the Americans have been attacking Iran on various fronts has really escalated the situation. I don't think Iran wants a regional war here. In fact, Iran has showed a lot of, if you will, it has shown a lot of restraint in the past year. We had the assassination of Iranian scientists at the end of December. We had the attack on Natanz, which happened actually less than a year before another attack on the same Iranian facilities. And during all this time, Iran has actually been trying to calm the situation. But at the same time, I think Iran wants to show that if push comes to shove, then it does have the capability to respond. Regarding the attack near Dimona, first of all, it's important to note that Israel's Iron Dome system was not able to intercept the missile. Mm-hmm. And the fact that it missed the Dimona plant, I think maybe was on purpose. I think the aim was not to hit Dimona, but was rather to show that there is the capability, either by Iran or Hezbollah, mm-hmm. to target sensitive Israeli systems if, in fact, a war should start between Iran and Israel.
Dr. Mousawi, the timing of the drone footage coincided with the ongoing meetings in Vienna between Britain, China, France, Germany, Iran, and Russia, who were there to discuss reviving the 2015 nuclear deal. But would such footage bring a leverage to the Iranian position, or rather would very much maybe hurt the talks at this time?
Well, I think the Israeli attack on Natanz had maybe two purposes. One was to derail the talks, because we know the Israelis do not want the talks to reach an agreement. But at the same time, I think the Israelis were trying to establish leverage for the Americans, and the fact that they were trying to hurt Iran's enrichment capabilities. But in reality, the attack actually had a reverse effect, because right after the attack, Iran started enrichment of 60%, essentially giving Iran leverage in the talks with the Americans. And the fact that these kinds of footage, as well as the attack on Dimona, is showing is that Iran is not a weak regional player here. It does have the means and the capabilities to respond. The fact that it has not responded in a forceful manner is because Iran does not want war. Nevertheless, we have to remember that restraint from the Iranian side cannot hold on forever. The Biden administration has to understand that if they don't bar the Israelis from such kind of attacks, then there is a very real possibility of war in the region. Mm-hmm. And this is a very dangerous scenario.
We are seeing that U.S. diplomats are not participating directly in these talks because Tehran firmly refuses any direct talks with the U.S. before all sanctions are lifted, and the results of lifting of that those sanctions are felt by both the government and the nation, the people of Tehran. What are Iran's options in the event that the U.S. refuses to lift the sanctions, then rather choose instead to ease those sanctions?
Well, I think from Iran's position specified by Ayatollah Khamenei is that unless the U.S. Lifts all the sanctions in one step, then Iran will not reach an agreement with them. And on the surface, this might seem like a harsh stance, but we have to remember the history of the past few years from Iran's perspective. When the nuclear deal was reached in 2015, it was under the assumption that Iran would limit its nuclear program, and in return it would receive economic incentives. But what happened was, especially during the Trump administration, the Americans left the deal very easily. And for a whole year, Iran, fully obliged by its side of the deal, and this was in response to promises by the Europeans that Iran would still receive the sanctions lifting incentives that were specified in the deal. In reality, Iran never received such benefits. Actually, Iran is selling less oil today than it was before the deal was signed in 2015. So if anything, Iran is worse off today than it was before the deal. Mm-hmm. And because of that, today Iran is saying that the Americans are not trustworthy. And unless they lift all sanctions at once, and Iran is able to verify that, so it's not only on paper, but they can actually verify that the sanctions have been lifted, then Iran does not really have any incentives to return to the deal. I think that's the real situation here. And because of that, I don't think we are going to see a breakthrough in the talks anytime soon, because the Biden administration is not really showing any flexibility so far.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Hamid Mousavi, political science professor at Tehran University, for talking to us about how the Islamic Revolutionary Guard released these drone footage of the U.S. aircraft carrier in the Persian Gulf, and how would that affect the talks, or the indirect talks, between the U.S. and Iran in Vienna for reviving the 2015 nuclear talks. Thank you very much for being with us. Please stay